Hi, I'm Tyler Foggett. Join me and my colleagues as we go beyond the headlines and deepen your understanding of the forces shaping our world today on The Political Scene, a newly updated podcast from The New Yorker. With episodes 3 times each week, The Political Scene accesses the sharpest minds in politics for insight and analysis about everything from abortion rights to the war in Ukraine. Make sure you're following The Political Scene, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
When Ukraine's allies in the West say they're getting tired of the war, many Ukrainians hear that and are dumbfounded.
USA, European Union, I don't want to be rude, but you have no right to say you are tired. Because if we are not tired, how come people from abroad are tired?
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Palestinians in Gaza do not want to leave, but a growing number of families feel like they have no choice.
The Egyptians will take something of a bribe, a very high bribe, to kind of sneak you through.
And selling your biometric info.
At a crowded shopping mall, long lines of people pose, no blinking, before a bank of round silver cameras about the size of bowling balls.
So what does the private AI company get out of the deal?
All those stories and more ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. It's been nearly 2 years since Russia began its full-scale invasion, and many are asking, can Ukraine continue to defend itself? U.S. military aid has been held up in Congress, and Russian forces have captured the city of Avdiivka.
There are also widespread reports that Ukraine is beginning to ration artillery shells and other ammunition. But one thing they have going for them, drones. The World's Daniel Offman reports from Kyiv.
The widespread use of drones started soon after the full-scale invasion.
Since this moment, it really became the war of drones.
This is Roman Lazinski. At 30 years old, he's one of the youngest members of Ukraine's parliament. He also was a soldier for more than a year, and he piloted drones. He says they were critical for 2 reasons. They're used for reconnaissance, they all have cameras, and they're used as weapons.
We destroyed a lot of Russian armored vehicles, even tanks, by small bombs and by drones.
The way it works is that an explosive device is strapped onto the drone. The drone is about the size of 2 footballs. And then using a remote control, a soldier flies the drone, crashing it into the target. Other drones can drop explosives like a bomber plane. These kinds of drones are cheap and easy to make. Some Ukrainians have even volunteered to assemble them at home.
It's between $300 and $600 or $700. This drone, which can damage tank or armored vehicle and stop it. It's a change maker now.
And that's why Ukraine is investing in drones. Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, said that this year they plan to produce 1 million drones. This is in part because Russia has a lot more artillery than Ukraine. So Lazinski says that Ukraine is using drones to compensate for that shortage.
If you don't have enough ammunition for your artillery systems, you have to use something else.
But Lozinski says that this war isn't just about the quantity of drones. It's also about technology and innovation. This is a workshop that produces high-end military drones. It's part of a Kyiv-based drone company called AirLogix. At the workshop, there's about 20 people constructing parts. Alexei, one of the workers here, is making a mold for the back wing of a drone. We focus on the quality, he says. We can't allow there to be any problems because there's a high level of responsibility here.
Patriotism is everywhere.
He says we're all patriotic here because we know what we're doing this work for. It's a matter of life and death, he says. Upstairs is the design bureau filled with experts in everything from computer science and design to aerodynamics. Vitaly Kolesnichenko is the CEO and founder of the company. He points to one of the computer screens.
This is our new intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance drone. We want to make it with more endurance, up to 10 hours, and to have less weight.
This drone is about the size of a bicycle and looks like a small plane. Drones like this can fly in the air for hours, and they've got cameras. They're like an eye in the sky. Anastasia Dakhovnik is one of the design engineers. She began working here soon after Russia's full-scale invasion.
I'm connected to almost with all processes in production, designing. Any task I have, I do it.
Dakhovnik says that it's rewarding to see her designs put into action. She says this job gives her a sense of purpose.
I'm very proud that I work for our victory, and I see that our job changes and helps our people, and it calms me.
CEO Vitaly Kolesnichenko says that they're in a race with Russia because Russia is also trying to produce high-quality military drones. That's something that Bohdan Danilov also thinks about. He's the drone project coordinator with the Pritula Foundation, a Kyiv-based nonprofit that helps provide equipment for the Ukrainian military.
When we find out something new, it's a matter of time that they will start doing it. The problem is who will be first, who will be smarter, and how effectively will be using it. That's like the question.
Danilov says he spends most of his time talking to troops on the front lines to understand their needs. He also trains soldiers on how to use drones. He said that drones have drastically changed the nature of this war.
The war right now is like on the television. You see everything. It's like Big Brother. You see the enemy a couple of kilometers away, what he's doing. They can see what we are doing. So now we have to work into the electronic warfare.
Electronic warfare in order to jam and disable the other side's drones. It's tit for tat. One side develops something and the other side tries to thwart it. Danilov says that soldiers on the front lines are motivated to keep innovating and fighting for their country. And he says that the war fatigue narrative is overblown.
I wouldn't say we are tired. I would say, like, you are tired. Like, USA, European Union. I don't want to be rude, but you have no right to say you are tired. Because if we are not tired, how come, like, people from abroad are tired?
Danilov echoes President Zelensky. He says that Ukraine doesn't need anyone to fight for them. They just need the weapons. In the meantime, though, Ukraine will use whatever it could get its hands on. And for now, that means producing a lot of drones.
The World's Daniel Offman has been reporting from Ukraine all this week ahead of the second anniversary of the full-scale invasion tomorrow. Before we let you go, Daniel, let's talk about the significance of this date for just a second. Last year, around the February 24th anniversary, the public diplomacy effort was kicked into high gear. President Biden, I remember, made a surprise visit. President Zelensky hosted a marathon press conference. What kinds of plans are in place to recognize the anniversary this year?
Yeah, so Zelensky will hold another big press conference on Sunday, and over the weekend, there are going to be commemorative events in Kyiv and all around the country. Now, remember that Russia is still firing rockets and drones, so because of that, Ukraine still avoids large gatherings. For some people, every day, though, is a reminder of what happened 2 years ago. Everyone in Ukraine has an app on their phone warning them whenever there's an air raid siren, and funerals for Ukrainian soldiers are really common. So that's just the reality in Ukraine right now.
You and I were together in Ukraine 1 year ago, and I remember everyone we spoke to was all in on the war effort. People expressed this unwavering confidence that Ukraine would win, at least the people who were in Ukraine that we were speaking with. What have you been hearing from Ukrainians as this war is about to enter year three? Is that confidence the same?
In some ways, the feeling is a little different right now, and that's mostly because of the situation on the front line. So remember, Carolyn, last year at the one-year anniversary, Ukraine was coming off of multiple successful military campaigns. So
Right. People
were riding that momentum and kind of expecting more of the same. But the front line hasn't really moved much over the last year. So there is some fatigue and also a lot of worry because Russia isn't slowing down its war effort. Here's Katerina Lifanova. I spoke with her in the Kharkiv metro as she was dropping off her son at school.
Все по-другому. Страх какой-то внутри, нет определенности.
She says, everything has changed. I feel this kind of fear inside of me. Things certainly didn't get better, but we live through each day, and thank God. Alifanova also said that she hopes for peace and she hopes for the war to end soon. Some other people who I spoke with didn't really want to reflect on the last 2 years, and they said this two-year anniversary doesn't really mean much to them. Here's Yuri Hapunchuk, a military veteran who fought on the front lines and lost his left leg after stepping on a Russian mine.
ну, 24-та, ну, то що, це дата, не дата. От дата буде, коли буде перемога, от тоді можна буде й подумати.
He says February 24th, is that really an important date? The important date will come when there's a victory. Then I'll think about it. Mm-hmm. So, Carolyn, there's a wide range of feelings and reactions to this upcoming anniversary.
So maybe a little more nuanced than it was a year ago. There will be a lot more to cover there in the months ahead, no doubt. The World's Daniel Offman, thank you for your continued reporting.
Thanks, Carolyn.
We might be getting closer to a universal approach to treating venomous snake bites. Research published this week found an antibody that's effective in neutralizing a key type of neurotoxin produced by a range of venomous snake species prevalent in South Asia, Africa, and Australia. Globally, nearly 3 million people are bitten by venomous snakes each year. Tens of thousands of them die, and hundreds of thousands of others are left permanently disabled. Joseph Jardine is one of the researchers on this project. He's an assistant professor at Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California. Joe, tell us about this synthetic antibody that you and your colleagues have come up with.
Yeah, so we've been looking at antibodies for a long time. So my career actually started out in HIV, where we were studying how antibodies neutralize HIV, which is a virus that has lots of diversity. We were doing that for a number of years, and what we realized is this actually is the same overall problem that you find dealing with snake venom. And so what we hypothesized is that we could leverage a lot of the same tools and technologies that we use to find our HIV antibodies to develop antibodies that would be broadly effective across different snake venom toxins. And it looks like this paper that we just published is our first success where we can show that it is, in fact, possible to make an antibody that's broadly effective across a toxin class within a snake venom.
Now, venom is a toxin and toxins can kill. But how is it that they can also cause permanent disabilities, as you say in the paper? What are we talking about there?
Yeah, so those would be, I think of the permanent disabilities more coming from the viper venom. So bear in mind, they're not designed to hurt people. They're designed to help the snake hunt. And so viper venoms are designed to cause the prey to bleed out. If you get bitten in the hand or the foot, this is something that may not be fatal, but you could lose that hand or that foot. And that ends up being, the magnitude of that ends up being amplified in a lot of the places where snake bite is prevalent because the people out there are going to be farmers and there's not going to be the social security nets.
Where are venomous snake bites the most prevalent?
So they're definitely the most prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa and India. There's a lot of snakes there. There's a lot of different snakes there. And people are living in close proximity to snakes, and that's a recipe for a lot of snake bites. And that's where the bulk of this is felt.
So this antibody could potentially be useful in precisely the places where it's needed.
The advantage here would be that this would be one antivenom that would work against everything. And so that would be really the best part because you could manufacture it, you know, in one sort of key area and then disseminate it everywhere. But the other thing, too, is when you look at existing antivenoms, they're made with a technology that's 100 years old. You know, you take the venom out of a snake and you inject it into a large animal, typically a horse. And so you immunize the horse with this venom until the horse develops an antibody response. So what you're delivering to the snake bite victims is actually just this big cocktail of different horse antibodies, of which maybe 10% are going to be reactive against the venom. And one of the main drawbacks from this as well is when you give a huge dose of horse antibody like that, a lot of times people have adverse reactions to the antibody. So you can get serum sickness all the way through severe anaphylaxis.
Now, what are the range of snake species whose venom could be counteracted with this new antibody?
Yeah, so this antibody neutralizes three-finger neurotoxins, and these toxins are found in the venom of lapid snakes. And so these are going to be your cobras and your mambas. These snakes, they have a number of different toxins in their venom. That's one of the things that's challenging about this. But we think that if we can neutralize the three-finger neurotoxins and the phospholipases, that should be sufficient to protect against pretty much any lapid bite in the world. And then expanding that a little bit further, you have the other class of snakes. These are going to be your vipers. The viper venoms, as we discussed earlier, they have venom that's designed to chew up tissue. Mm. So the goal would be to make something, yeah, where we can have four or five different antibodies that neutralize the couple of key different toxin classes, but that do so like our antibody that we just published, where one antibody works across all different snake toxins.
That's interesting. So this antibody could be used theoretically to treat venom from a range of snakes.
Yeah, that's the idea. Right now, with existing antivenoms, they're really effective against one snake. And so the hope here is that we'll be able to make one antivenom that should be effective against any snake in the world.
Joseph Jardine is an assistant professor at Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California. You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Israeli government today released its most detailed post-war plan yet for the Gaza Strip. It calls for indefinite Israeli control over not just Gaza, but also the West Bank. It also rejects a future role for the Palestinian Authority in Gaza. The plan contradicts the Biden administration's priorities, but the Secretary of State today said he is withholding judgment.
In the meantime, people in Gaza say daily life there is reaching a breaking point. More than 1.5 million people are crowded into the southern city of Rafah near the border with Egypt. That border crossing is tightly controlled by Egypt and Israel. But as the world's Shirin Jafari reports, more and more families in Gaza are making the painful decision to try and leave, even though they fear that Israel won't let them ever return.
Omar and his fiancée, Sarah, were supposed to get married in December.
I bought an apartment for myself in installment, furnished it, and took care of the smallest details in it. In preparation for our marriage.
But their marriage never happened. Omar and his family were displaced from their home in Gaza City because of the war. Sarah and her family stayed behind. The couple didn't see each other for 52 days, Omar says.
We were planning a nice, quiet life and spend honeymoon outside Gaza.
The plan was to go to Egypt for their honeymoon, to scuba dive and relax on the beach. But now Sarah and her family are sheltering inside a warehouse in Rafah City. Omar and his family are staying with a friend. Their homes are no longer standing. Neither is the wedding hall they booked for their ceremony.
If the army enters Rafah, there is no other place for us to go.
The Israeli army has been inching towards the city in the past few weeks. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been warning about a military operation in Rafah to root out Hamas. Omar says every day is a fight to stay alive.
Now I want to leave Gaza with my fiancé and my family. Egypt is asking for a high amount of money to leave.
Omar didn't come to this decision lightly, he says. Gaza is home. He wants to stay and raise his family there. But as the situation gets dire, Omar and other Palestinians see no choice but to leave. Right now, the only way out is through Egypt.
The Egyptians will take something of a bribe, a very high bribe, to kind of like sneak you through.
Rania has been helping her cousin's family raise money to leave Gaza. She and Omar didn't want to use their last names in this story because of the sensitivity of the topic. Rania's cousin is also in Rafah City, along with his wife, three teenagers, and a five-year-old. She tries to stay in touch with them.
The kids are really petrified and they're cold. They're scared to sleep in the house. They're scared to sleep outside of the house. I don't know if there is a house anymore. I mean, it's been a miserable, miserable few months.
Through research and word of mouth, Rania's cousin found a travel agency in Cairo that will charge about $5,000 per person to get them out. He estimates that he will need $30,000 to get the whole family out. Rania has been helping him crowdsource this money through an online platform.
I have never done this. We're maybe about just under a third of the way there, but there's still a lot more to go.
Families I spoke to for this story say they have no one to turn to. They're confused and desperate. They have so many unanswered questions, like will they raise the money they need? How long will it take? Will the agency in Egypt take the money and run? But most importantly, will they be alive by the time they raise the money? Ahmed Ben Shamsi with Human Rights Watch says bribery at the Egyptian border is not new.
Even before the war and before we were in this tragic humanitarian situation that we are right now, the tariffs of the tansiq, meaning what people had to pay to these private travel agencies, fluctuated from several hundred to several thousand US dollars.
Human Rights Watch looked into one agency called Hala Consulting and Tourism, he says.
According to a human rights activist and a journalist who investigated this issue and who spoke with us on the condition of anonymity, Hala had very close ties to Egyptian security services.
Not only that, he says, but also most of the tourism agency's employees were former army officers. Hala Agency did not respond to my messages for this story, but last month the head of Egypt's State Information Service, Diyar Rashwan, denied the allegations that his country is taking bribes from Palestinians desperate to leave Gaza. Still, every day, people with friends and family in Gaza post new fundraising campaigns online. Rania, who's trying to get her cousin and his family out, tells me the fundraiser has created divisions within her own family who want to keep their roots in Gaza.
No one leaves and we kind of die on this land. And if you leave, then Israel gets what they want. And if everyone's family starts leaving, then we've left them Gaza.
But she says it's easy to make these judgments from the safety of the outside. Some relatives have also told her asking money from strangers has brought shame to the family. Rania says she's determined to help her cousin in the decision he has made, especially given the level of despair she's been hearing in the voices of people inside Gaza.
I mean, everything is gone, right? So yeah, I'm hearing a lot of suicidal ideation. Culturally, religiously, it's not something that we do. And I haven't heard of anyone go ahead and do it, but I have heard people praying not to wake up.
The loss and grief, she says, is all just too heavy these days. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Many of the biggest global film stars are in Germany right now. They're at the annual Berlin International Film Festival, also known as the Berlinale. Martin Scorsese just won a Lifetime Achievement Award there.
I think the film festival has the opportunity to introduce to the world, basically making the world closer and smaller, people knowing each other and knowing each other's cultures.
There's a parallel film festival happening in Berlin as well. It's called the Taxi Film Fest. Germany's Hello Taxi is one of the films being played there. So is Scorsese's classic Taxi Driver and a South Korean movie of the same name. The festival's theme is the same as its venue. All the films are being played in the back of a taxi.
We took out all the seats in the back. We installed a TV set, a DVD, a Blu-ray player.
Klaus Meyer created the Taxi Film Fest. He clearly loves taxis and has been driving his own around Berlin since 1985. He says they're part of the social fabric of the city. But this film festival is about more than that.
Meyer says it's a protest over the Berlinale's sponsorship by Uber. The ride-hailing app is the official transit option for filmmakers to zip around Berlin this weekend. And Meyer wants to call out the organizers for that decision.
So, in fact, they're supporting an institution, enterprise, which is destroying our not only commercial but our social needs.
The traditional taxi business in many world cities has lost out to ride-hailing services like Uber and Lyft. Klaus Meyer says Berlin's taxi drivers are facing real financial issues. He hopes his counter-festival draws attention to that and maybe even inspires people to hop in a cab instead of booking a car on their phones.
You are listening to The World. Tens of thousands of years ago, people traversed a path of migration out of Africa toward what is now the heart of the Middle East. We'll hear from an explorer who walked that same route in modern times.
The first migrants I met were dead. They were people who had perished in the desert of thirst.
Walking through the Horn of Africa to the shores of the Red Sea, that's ahead on The World. You're with The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Here's a question for you. How much would you sell your eyes for? Well, a biometric scan of your irises, to be exact. Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, has come up with a price. He's offering $80 worth of cryptocurrency to anyone who lets his machines scan their eyes. But what's he doing this for? The World's Jerry Haddon went to L'Hospitalet, a suburb of Barcelona, to find out.
At a crowded shopping mall, long lines of people pose, no blinking, before a bank of round silver cameras about the size of bowling balls. These orbs, as the cameras are called, capture the unique patterns of participants' irises and upload that biometric data to a virtual cloud controlled by Sam Altman, the guy who brought us ChatGPT. What could go wrong? Probably nothing, people in Spain seem to think, judging by the thousands offering up their irises week after week. Among them is Myra.
She doesn't want her last name used out of concern, she says, for her privacy.
Yo creo que son 2 días de sueldo y pues sin que te cueste nada, pues bueno, las personas que
they just paid me the equivalent of 2 days' wages, she tells me, leaving the mall with her young daughter. For those of us who've come to Spain as immigrants, she says, we've got nothing to lose. We just need to get by. What Mayra got for her eye scan, 10 tokens of the new cryptocurrency WorldCoin. On this day, the tokens sell for about $8 each. Most of the people I speak to here say, like Mayra, that they simply need the quick dough. Which is why this young man who asks for total anonymity waits just outside the Orb station offering cash for people's new tokens. I'm a human bank machine, he says, flashing a wad of bills. Let's say someone walks out with 80 euros in tokens, he says, I give them 60, maybe 65. That's about 60 US dollars. On a good day, says the human ATM machine, he can earn more than $1,000. If the value of the token goes up, he stands to make bank. And if they go down, he'll lose. All of this has created a buzz that Altman is banking on to draw people in. According to his WorldCoin company, Tools for Humanity, nearly 4 million people have signed up to be scanned for tokens globally since its July launch, from Europe to Africa to the United States. You never know, orbs may be on their way to a mall near you. But what's Altman's motive here? Possible riches from the new cryptocurrency aside, he says he's just trying to help humanity.
I think there's a lot of things that one can imagine if something like WorldCoin works. Think about governance, how we're going to differentiate between what is done by people and what is generated by machines.
That was Altman on WorldCoin's YouTube channel. The company did not respond to an interview request. Differentiating between people and machines. Altman has said publicly that our irises could be the key. Each is unique, can't be copied, and could become the safest way for us to, say, shop or bank online. We could use it to stop deep fake fraud generated by artificial intelligence. And if machines end up replacing human labor one day, Altman has even envisioned using the irises to pay everyone on Earth a basic minimum wage. It's global economic justice, but governments and private organizations are skeptical. India and Brazil have clamped down on the number of orbs they're letting in. France, Germany, and Spain itself are investigating whether WorldCoin is breaking the EU's strict privacy laws. Miguel Crespo Moran is with a Spanish consumer protection group called CECU. He says Altman's intentions might very well be good, but that doesn't mean our irises, and therefore our identities, are safe with him.
Nosotros decimos que hay que guardar bien los datos del domicilio de una persona.
We often tell people to keep their home addresses safe, he says, but at least that can change and become useless to wrongdoers after some years, say if you move. But irises are forever, he says, even if young people signing up are not thinking of the consequences of a company having that information. On a recent morning, I go for an iris scan myself to try to understand just what everyone gets and gives away. My appointment's at an orb station in an empty warehouse in downtown Barcelona. A couple of security guards wave me in. There's nothing here but a folding table with 4 silver orbs on camera stands. Employees aren't allowed to talk to reporters, but when I ask what the scans are for, one worker says they're just to prove we're human before we can collect the free tokens. There was no mention of a global database, one that could one day ID everyone in the world. But isn't my physical presence here proof enough for the system, I ask? You can see that I'm not a robot, right? To which a worker responds, showing up is not enough. Robots these days, he says, can imitate people. Before the scan, you download the WorldCoin app. It asks whether you want to accept their privacy conditions. You can actually say no, but whatever you choose, says Crespo Moran, what you're really being asked to do is trust. To trust a company to do what they've promised, to keep your personal data private and secure for the rest of your life, since your iris ID will stay the same whether you're 18 or 80. Which is why I ultimately back out, and why the human ATM machine outside that mall says he won't go near the scanners either, even as he profits from this handsome hustle.
No confío. Nadie da dinero gratis, para empezar.
I don't trust the orbs, he says, as he works the crowd offering cash for crypto. Nobody gives away money, he says, without asking for something in return. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, L'Hospitalet, Spain.
The people making the journey from Latin America to the southern U.S. border come from all over the world. Lots from Venezuela, Haiti, Ecuador, Colombia. But the number of people coming from China is on the rise. Muzaffar Chisti is a senior fellow with the Migration Policy Institute, and he's based in New York.
This fiscal year, which is what began in October, close to 30,000 Chinese migrants have been encountered both at the northern and the southern border. And that's out of 1.2 million that have been encountered in the same period. It's obviously a growing number, but it's still a very small fraction of the overall number of migrants showing up at both the northern and the southern border.
Can you tell me what some of the driving factors are that is increasing the number of people leaving China and trying to come to the U.S.?
China had one of the most stringent COVID-related restrictions for both domestic and international travel. So there's kind of a pent-up feeling from that. But reporting shows that there are obviously a combination of economic factors. Large number of middle-class people are leaving for better jobs. There are reports of repression and the obvious political factors. So quite a combination.
The story of Chinese immigration here in the U.S. goes back a long time, to the 1800s at least. Can you tell me a little bit more about numbers in recent decades? It kind of fell off for a while when the Chinese economy was booming. Is that right?
Chinese and Indians started taking over Mexicans about 5 years ago for the largest group. But large number of them also come legally. It's actually very difficult for Chinese to get visas to come lawfully because there are long back lines, especially for Chinese and Indian nationals. But the Chinese migration to the U.S. has very historic, unfortunate roots. We put the Chinese Exclusion Act as the first real restrictive federal law in the country. So I think some of us are concerned that this new focus on the Chinese crossers, both at the northern and southern border, is sort of a reminiscent of harking back on the history against Chinese immigrants, which is unfortunate.
As you mentioned, most people coming from China immigrate to the U.S. legally. What do we know about the routes that people who attempt to cross illegally at the border are taking?
So many of them are coming to the Darien Gap. This is the fourth largest group of people crossing. That's a significant number. So typically, Chinese are coming either to Istanbul or to Addis Ababa in Africa or to Ecuador. Ecuador has become an important route because Ecuador does not require Chinese to have a visa to enter. That becomes very inviting. And then they make the route from Ecuador to Tijuana, one of the more popular posts for entry to the U.S. But the numbers in Europe, in Australia, in South Korea of Chinese going to those places are also rising. Actually, the rate of change in those three posts is higher than the rate of change in the U.S.
Do you have any sense of whether this increase is temporary or whether it might keep growing?
Chinese nationals reach the border, they are reasonably sure that they will get through to the inside of the country, be able to apply for asylum. And the pass rate for asylum, the approval rate, is 55%. So it's like better than half your chance to get asylum. So I think the only way it will decrease if people get the sense that if you reach the border, you're not necessarily going to get inside the United States. And if you get inside the United States, you're not necessarily granted a high percentage in your asylum grant application. So unless the asylum system is reformed, I don't think I can see a big change in the decision of Chinese coming to the border.
Muzaffar Chisti is a senior fellow with the Migration Policy Institute, and he joined us from New York.
And now, a few things you might have missed. Shamima Begum lost a court appeal over the removal of her British citizenship. Begum left her home in Britain in 2015, traveled to Syria, and joined ISIS. She was 15 years old at the time. She's fighting to have her citizenship reinstated and be allowed to return to the UK from Syria. Begum's lawyers say she's likely to appeal today's ruling.
Some history was made last night with the first moon landing in 50 years. The spacecraft Odysseus was built and managed by a private company, Intuitive Machines. It did get an assist from NASA equipment when there was a glitch in the laser navigation system as the lander approached the moon. NASA hailed the Odysseus landing near the moon's south pole as a giant leap forward for all of humanity. The agency hopes the landing will spark more investment in space travel.
And the government in Germany has legalized cannabis. People over the age of 18 will be allowed to possess, use, and even grow weed. Buying the drug legally will be a bit more complicated, though, as Germans will be required to join a so-called cannabis social club.
And that's a few things you might have missed.
When Hamas gunmen stormed into their kibbutz on October 7th last year, Ayelet Cohn and her husband Shahar Schnurman survived by locking themselves in a safe room. They didn't come out for 30 hours. And when they did, the couple was told it would be a while before they could return home permanently. Most of the surviving residents of the kibbutz are still living in hotels or with families. Many say they're too afraid to go back to the scene of the massacre. But in December, Ayelet and Shahar decided it was time to go home. Rebecca Rossman paid them a visit on kibbutz Kfar Aza.
So this is my house. It's not very big, as you can see. And this is the safe room.
56-year-old Ayelet Cohn is giving me a tour of her modest home in kibbutz Kfar Aza, just a mile from northern Gaza. The safe room she's talking about is actually her bedroom. Cohn opens her window and pulls on a sliding concrete frame, casting us into darkness.
Okay, this is when it closes. Okay? Now imagine yourself, this is where we, like we were, because there was no electricity.
Ayelet and her husband Shahar sat silently in the dark for 30 hours to the soundtrack of gunshots and screams from outside. Eventually, Israeli soldiers showed up in an armored jeep and brought them to safety at a nearby gas station. Hundreds of people there were lining up to be bussed off to other parts of the country. When a soldier asked them where they wanted to go, they said back home to the kibbutz.
He looked at us and he was like with a lot of pity in his eyes. And he said, it's going to take us 3 to 4 days to clear the kibbutz from terrorists.
It would take a while for them to learn that 63 of the kibbutz's 970 residents had been murdered, 18 kidnapped, and dozens injured. For a while, Ayelet and Shahar lived in a hotel in Tel Aviv, but they couldn't stand it. After a month of crying and another month of reflecting, on December 10th, they decided to go home.
And the night we came back, which was a lot noisier than what it is right now, was the middle of the war in the north part of Gaza, and it was the best sleep I had in months, because it's even if you are going to a wonderful hotel and you're having a wonderful time, there's always that night when you go back home and you sleep in your own bed and you feel great. That's why how it felt.
We're hearing sound. What is that sound?
That's the sound of the war in Gaza.
This is Ayelet's husband, Shahar Schnurman. He says right now there are only about 20 people living on the kibbutz full time, which he understands. One thing he misses most, though, is the sound of children playing.
Kids are a noise of life. Yeah, I'm very happy to hear laughing, talking, you know.
These days, most visitors to the kibbutz are journalists or groups of Israelis, and even tourists, who come to survey the destruction. Shahar admits that at first, this made him uncomfortable, a bit like being an animal in a zoo.
I am the biggest circus in Israel right now, I know it.
But over time, he and Ayelet talked about it, and they decided they wanted people to come so they could understand what happened here.
You want us to open your door? So we open and show them and talk with them.
I think it's a life-changing experience to see what happened. There is nothing that somebody would tell you that would be as strong as seeing it in your own eyes.
Ayelet offers to show us around, to look at some of the destruction with her. In front of us, there are several blocks of flats, most of which were occupied by young people in their late teens and early 20s. This was one of the worst-hit areas. Many of the homes are charred to a crisp. There's smears of blood on some of the front doors and burnt mattresses scattered across the road in front. At one point, Ayelet sees a visitor trying to enter one of the homes and politely asks her to step back. She says this is another reason she wanted to come back to the kibbutz, so there would be a local here, ensuring visitors weren't overstepping any boundaries. The destruction here is astounding. When we get back to their house, Shachar points to his neighbor's roof, which was blown out after being hit by Hamas missile.
It's a casualty of war. Usually the government's supposed to pay for it. And they don't want to pay, they don't want to help us.
Shachar says in recent weeks, he's received visits from politicians from all over the world, but not a single member of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government, or a single penny to help repair the damage, despite promises. They hope that will change, but they aren't too optimistic, so they're finding light in other ways. When they arrived back home in December, it was Hanukkah, the Jewish festival of lights. One of the first things Ayelet insisted they do was put up a set of rainbow LED lights on their front porch.
And I told Shachar, this light will be on non-stop.
Maybe the kidnaps see it. They give them hope.
Light is hope, Shachar says.
And we hope that people see it.
They say the day the hostages come back is the day they'll take the lights down. Until then, they'll keep glowing. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Kfar Azah, Israel.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. These days, the Horn of Africa and the Red Sea region are known for being conflict zones. But 60,000 years ago, they were pathways out of Africa for our oldest ancestors. National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek has been following the migration routes of early humans from their origins in Africa across the globe to the southern tip of South America. His journey is ongoing, but today we're looking back to 2013, when Salopek walked to the Red Sea.
About 35 miles into Djibouti, on the parched Gagadé Plain. A wind blows through the dune palm fronds. If you listen hard enough, it sounds almost like rain. It hasn't rained here, though, for a year.
Wow. No rain for a year. Paul Salopek, described the landscape in Djibouti.
Yeah, Djibouti is a country that not too many people beyond Africa are familiar with. It's a small place, about the size of the U.S. state of Vermont, and it is incredibly arid. I crossed into Djibouti across a border that was desert on one side, desert on the other. Just unchanging dryness. Temperatures up to 120 plus degrees during the day. There was a drought, so there had been no rain for a year. And that was very hard on the local nomadic people who herd animals.
Now, by retracing those same steps to Djibouti, what insights did you get into the lives of the people who walked this same route 60,000 years ago?
I was literally walking in many places the same corridors of dispersal of early humans, literally on top of their bones in some cases, going through ancient fossil fields. And what was haunting about it was this connection with the current world, with current events. That is, there are still migrants walking these ancient trails today and often falling on their journeys. For the first 50 days of my walk, the first migrants I met were dead. They were people who had perished in the desert of thirst. And so our bones are being added to a new layer of humankind that's been using this kind of funnel, this bottleneck out of Africa into Arabia, as you mentioned, for tens and tens of thousands of years. It was haunting.
Absolutely. I mean, right now, the whole globe is experiencing an incredible amount of migration in all directions.
I wish it were being propelled by positive forces, but as we all know, it's often negative reasons for leaving. I think the UN is saying that close to a billion people today, that's like one in every seven, are now living and working outside of the place where they were born, whether it's internal within their country or across borders. It takes enormous pressure to get people to uproot and move. And I think we need to remember that as we deal with these very complex issues of mobile populations.
I'm curious, do we have any idea how Djibouti looked 60,000 years ago when these early humans were there in terms of topography or vegetation or anything?
So I walked up the Rift Valley of Africa. Imagine this corridor, 40 miles wide, with kind of mountains or cliffs on each side that were 2,000 feet high. And it acted like a superhighway for ancient humans going way back, even pre-humans, right? I mean, I'm talking, the people I'm following are Homo sapiens. But even pre-humans used this corridor to leave the mother continent. And what scientists were telling me is that at various times, it's been quite a bit wetter. Big rivers that had swampy banks that were teeming with wildlife, hippos. I mean, they found hippo kills with stone tools next to them that are 150,000 years old. I think if the ancient people who I'm following could get a look at it today, they would hardly believe how incredibly bone dry it is. White salt flats, black lava fields, and almost no water.
And of course, today, modern Djibouti has a thriving port. What's the scene when you arrive there?
It was a bit surreal, to be honest, after having spent, again, you know, a month and a half coming out of the desert with first my Ethiopian and then my Djiboutian walking partners, all of whom were the descendants of camel shepherds, you know, coming into a modern port that was like never quiet. The lights were burning all through the night, and it was just astonishing, the contrast between the ancient and the new, just from a few days of walking out of Africa.
Now, in Djibouti, you boarded a ship that also was carrying 8,000 sheep, hundreds of camels, 20 crew members, and 3 veterinarians. What was that like?
So I confronted a problem when I reached the sea. After all this desert walking, I get to the Gulf of Aden. It's kind of a sense of celebration. I've reached the sea, like the ancient ancestors that I'm following.
Yes.
But what do I do next? I couldn't walk up the coast of Africa to continue because at the time, Eritrea was in a war with Ethiopia. The borders were frozen. So I had to find a ship. And at that time, there was a big problem with Somali piracy. Groups of men going out and kind of taking down cargo ships and holding crews for ransom. You know, movies have been made about it. The only ship that would accept a stranger with kind of a dubious explanation about why he's getting on their ship was this Syrian manned, basically floating ark.
So you were sharing space with all these animals.
There was literally pieces of hay kind of floating off in the air in the wake of this old ship. And it was an old Italian car ferry, but they had converted it into a floating farm. And it was very strange. Down below in the decks were all these camels. And as the ship was rocking, all of their heads would kind of rock in unison. It was like a forest that was moving in the dim bells of this ship.
How long did the trip take?
It took just a matter of days. You know, ships steam day and night, 24 hours. The crew were really interesting, I'll just add, because most of them were from Syria, and they were almost as homeless as I was. So they couldn't really go back and pick up their lives in their home country, which at the time was deep, deep into a very bloody civil war. And so they were kind of stuck on their own boat as well, just steaming from port to port around the Red Sea.
Now, the ship that you were on went north from Djibouti through the Bab al-Mandeb. That's a choke point between the Indian Ocean and the Red Sea. And it's in the news these days with commercial ships being fired on by Yemen's Houthi rebels. American and British warships are now patrolling the waters. When you read about the conflict in the Red Sea region today, what goes through your mind?
That in a certain sense, Carol, not much has changed. Whatever it was, 11 years ago when I started, it was a security zone also. It was a place that was kind of dangerous for commercial shipping to go through because of piracy. Today, because of the situation in Gaza, because of the situation in Yemen, these kind of dangers have kind of just replaced the old ones. So it remains kind of a dicey place to go through. So you put it well, it's a choke point. It's a very narrow space through which thousands of ships each year carry a lot of goods, including oil. So it's strategic. And navies from nations across the world patrol it pretty much constantly.
Paul Salopek's project is called The Out of Eden Walk. He'll be back to tell us more about his journey. And you want to see his photographs, videos, and stories from some of the many places he's already visited. It's all at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org. And you can find that link at our website, easier to remember. We're at theworld.org.
The World is a co-production of GBH, Boston, and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.